The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Well, it's been a few years since Irving Welsh was last with us on the programme, but we're delighted to have the man who wrote Trainspotting, his latest novel Resolution, and many other novels in between with us here on the programme. He's going to be at the West Cork Literary Festival on Sunday the 14th of July at 6:30 in the Maritime Hotel alongside his friend Emer Martin. Irvine, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt.
Now, we've got lots to talk about in your choices for the Culture Club. We start all the time with music. And we always ask everybody to give us the first single that they can remember actually buying. And you've gone with T-Rex and you've gone with a track called Jeepster. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, I just loved this track. And it was, that was in the days when singles were 50p and albums were £2.50, you know. So it was actually more cost effective to buy an album than it was a single. And I planned to get the Electric Warrior album, but I couldn't resist getting Jeepster. And I remember I was almost in tears when it only got to number two. It was Benny Hill's The Fastest Milkman in the West kept it off the charts. And I just loved Mark Bowen. I loved the feel of this song, you know, because it's like it's one of these things that it's a kind of love song. It's a sort of it's about a guy kind of really being kind of besotted by this very cool kind of woman. And you know, I was too young you're at that age where you're aware of these emotions, and you're aware of these feelings kind of bursting up inside you, but you still think it's a bit kind of daft, the idea of having a girlfriend. You know, you're still like kicking a ball around and all that stuff with your mates. So it was quite an interesting time, and the song was almost like a kind of move from childhood into a sort of adolescence in a way.
Let's hear a little bit of Jeepster.
You're my love.
Jeepster by T-Rex. And Irvin, I have lost count of the amount of times T-Rex has come up amongst men of your generation, I suppose, in the Culture Club. It's very much for men in their 60s have a big grow still for T-Rex.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like it was a kind of segue into Bowie, basically. And it was that thing that he had that kind of sort of ambivalent camp that was quite sexy. And the girls really used to go crazy over Mark Bolan, like, you know. So we kind of thought that, I think you almost thought that by playing sort of Jeepster enough, they would go crazy over you, basically, you know, that some kind of osmosis would be in effect. But I remember, like, my pals, Colin Campbell and Dougie Webster, like, Colin and I had gone to Band Parts to get the single, and we were playing it, and I used to play it with my cousin Janice. She was obsessed with Mark Bolan. She was a kind of absolutely crazy Mark Bolan fan. And that kind of made me aware of the effect that it was having on girls. So I thought, I'm going to bring this single at school and all that. And, you know, the lasses that I fancy in the art class might kind of be enthralled by my presence as a sort of Mark Bolan sort of aficionado. But Colin and Dougie and I wanted to start a band straight away. This was, you know, you think this is it. I want to be in a group like this. And we still do to this day.
You mentioned Bowie already, and you've nominated him in two of the categories. First of all, for your favourite album, Station to Station from 1976, which was his 10th studio album, the one that came directly after Young Americans. Why have you picked Station to Station?
I always think it's great when you see an artist in transition, and Bowie had more transitions than anybody else. I mean, for kind of working class kids of my generation, he was a one-man art school, basically. You know, he took us, he introduced us to not just to, you know, the music from, you know, from Anthony Newley to sort of the Velvet Underground, you know, and Iggy Pop, and you know, straight through to the, you know, the New York Dolls, and then he took us into soul music with you know, Luther Vandross and Young Americans era, and then he took us into Kraftwerk with the with electronic music, and he kept doing this, he kept reinventing himself, and this was a period, you know, in between. This was in between Young Americans and the sort of the kind of the Kraftwerk influenced Berlin period. And Station to Station is just that incredible album where his voice kind of was really coming of age during Young Americans, but it just really comes of age as this massively kind of potent, powerful instrument, building on the vocalization of Diamond Dogs and Young Americans. And it's just an absolutely virtuoso kind of masterpiece of singing, singing. And it has just... you know, this was in his big cocaine era, and he was kind of quite lost and a bit sort of, but he really kind of, managed to sort of kind of smash some real art out of that kind of dark period in his life. And it's such a fantastic album.
The track we've picked out is Wild as the Wind. Still listen to Bowie, Irvin?
All the time. Never got him off. And you know, he made so many fabulous albums, and he left so much great work behind. And it's funny, it's like you know, it was his death was so tragic because there was always more to come from him. You know what I mean? He was relentless. He just never stopped. If he had a vision or an idea, he just pursued it and realized it. You know, so. It was a kind of heartbreaker when he was taken from us, because he wasn't spent as an artist. He was actually doing some of his most exciting and interesting work as he died, basically.
You also have him for one of the two best gigs you were ever at, when you saw him play at Murrayfield in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I mean, I remember me and my pal Dave Todd, we had these, we had taken this work and... Part-time work, in the Register General's Office for Scotland, and they issued us these kind of very official-looking civil service passes. So we pretended to be security and pushed our way right down to the very front. So I was practically standing underneath him, and he was on the stage at Murrayfield. It started to rain, and he put on this white cagoule, and you never thought that anybody could be so cool in a white cagoule. I just wanted to buy a white cagoule after it.
Did you?
I didn't know because I just knew I'd never look as cool as him.
Well, we haven't got him from Murrayfield, but this is from when he played live at The Point in Dublin in 2003.
Thank you. That's a lot. From ripping up the stars from his spice. Funky little Bob Rice. Television man is crazy, saying we're too loud and ignorant. Man, I don't need TV when I got T-Rex. Rolling your gas, I'm a dope dad.
All the young dudes.
Fabulous.
You mentioned...
He wrote for Mott the Hoople, which was a big hit for them.
You also mentioned Iggy Pop, and he is down as your favourite band or artist. Why Iggy Pop?
Well, he is the most dynamic live performer of all time. And, you know, the weird thing about him now is that he's no spring chicken, and he's had a lot of kind of issues with hips and knees and all that. But he still just throws himself around on the stage. There's no more exciting performer in the world. And that's quite an amazing feat for a guy who's in his late 70s. He's just an absolute, an exciting live performer, but also one of the most, if you look at his back catalogue, and again, you look at all the things that he's done and all the things that he's been involved in, all the kind of the great songs that he's produced and the great albums that he's produced and is still producing now. I mean, his last one was absolutely amazing. Again, it's a timeless phenomenon of a star. And, you know, he should have been the one that because of his lifestyle, he should have gone before kind of Lou Reed and David Bowie, but he's still in there swinging. And he's a neighbour of mine in Miami, and I see him around quite a bit. And he's just this force of nature, and one of the most bookish, intelligent guys off the stage that you're likely to meet.
But also, given that Train Spotting was possibly, it must have been a thrill for you, I assume, to have it turned in, a great novel turned into a great movie, to have Iggy Pop's Lust for Life associated with Train Spotting so readily by many people.
Yeah, I mean, it was fabulous. And I mean, it was like, and it, you know, it did help kind of resurrect him a bit, you know, gave him a sort of boost and introduced him to a whole new audience. And it was like, to me, it's great to be able to, because he gave me so much. I mean, he was almost like a kind of surrogate big brother. He gave me the whole rebel aesthetic that I aspired to when I was younger, kind of a teenager and all that. He was the sort of the underscorer of my own personal rebellion. And it was just, when you've idolized someone to that extent, to be able to give them something back is one of the biggest thrills. I mean, you very, very rarely get that in life. But to be able to sort of pay homage to somebody who's given you so much, it's just fabulous.
It's not Lust for Life we're going to play from Iggy Pop, it's Frenzy. And ironically, given that we're talking to the author of Trainspotting, would you believe I've been told that I have to give the audience a language warning before I play a bit of this song?
Yeah.
frenzy by Iggy Pop, and despite the language warning, I might still be in trouble with the regulators over that. What manic energy, though, Irvin, that he had.
Well, this is him now. You know, this is a newer track that he's done. You know, and he's still like the king of punk rock, basically. You know, when he wants to be, then he turns into Frank Sinatra. He's like the Del Cato voice that he has, that kind of sort of smoky nightclub kind of really haunting kind of deep voice. And then he's back smashing it again, complete Stooges style. Like, you know, he's pretty incredible.
Trainspotting was not the only one of your great books to be turned into an excellent movie. And you have nominated as your favourite movie, Filth, which starred James McAvoy based on your book. Tell us how happy you were with the adaptation.
Oh, it was fabulous. It's a very difficult film because it's a very difficult book, and it had to be kind of hard-edged. I mean, we knew it was going to be very Marmite kind of right from the start. And, you know, I think it's still in the top 10 of the biggest grossing British indie films of all time, Trainspotting being number one. But Filth is number 9. It's been a really, it's been a very successful film, and it's sold all over the world. And the reason it did was James, basically. I mean, John's script and direction are obviously first class, but John Baird. But James McAvoy's performance is a massive kind of tour de force. And I mean, I work with some great actors. I've been really lucky. I mean, I'm working with Dougray Scott now in Crime, who's absolutely brilliant. And obviously all the Trainspotting guys like Bobby and the two Ewans, Johnny Lee Miller, they're just all exceptional actors. But James McAvoy just kind of blew me away. You know, he's just, you know, the way that he does all these emotional transitions.
I'm sorry, for those, those Irvin who aren't aware of either the novel or the movie, explain Filth.
Yeah, it's about a corrupt, mentally ill cop who is trying to get promotion at work, and he's trying to take out all these opponents, all these enemies at work. While there's a sort of very sensitive, kind of racially motivated crime that's going on in the background that the top brass want him to solve. And he's not really interested in doing that. All he wants to do is get promotion. So it's about the corruption of the human spirit and about the way that organizations corrupt people. It's just absolutely fabulous from him, you know. It's funny because I saw him in this M. Night Shyamalan thing with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, you know. And, you know, they both seem to be old guys now. They were kind of phoning it in a bit, you know. A film called Glass, and it didn't really kind of do particularly well. But again, James is absolutely phenomenal in it. He just dominates the whole film. He plays this mad kind of twisted, freaky guy who's got all these kind of bizarre superpowers, but he has a split personality. He plays about five characters in once. And it struck me again that the transitions that he does them so quick and so completely that he doesn't just play one character, he plays a multitude of characters. And because the Bruce Robertson character in Filth is supposed to be this kind of deranged presence who's kind of, you know, who has this dichotomy with this tapeworm growing inside him, which is an alternate self. It needed an actor of that ability. And there really are few and far between. And James is just one of these guys who can do anything, basically.
Okay. Well, let's play a clip from Filth.
Don't even think about defending Gilman.
Well, I'm going to have to consider my position in that one, Bob.
Bruce, things are bloody difficult for me at the moment with this murder case nuisance. On top of that, not only is there a latent Nazi racist homophobe, but a bloody Jesse boy in the hat for the inspector's post.
Now listen, are you referring to Brother Ingalls here? Because if you are...
How can we have someone of his disposition leading fellow officers? Policy or no bloody policy? I won't pretend I don't find the idea of two men doing it to each other totally disgusting. But that's by the way.
I still don't see what that's going
to... Oh, come on, Bruce! How can you have confidence in a man who is constantly undressing you with his eyes, masturbating over images of you? It'd just be a compromise.
Surely that's a bit caveman, Bob. You know, in some parts of the country, the force even advertised in the gay press now.
This isn't some parts of the country! This is Scotland, by Christ!
What are you here to remind me? That 1990s Scotland, was it?
Yes, and I'll tell you what, that is actually the one scene that even James was slightly upstaged because it was John Sessions, a brilliant actor who died a few years ago, sadly. And John was a fabulous actor and performer. And John was like, John was actually a gay man. And he had to play this kind of rampant homophobe. And he loved it. He loved every second of it. And he got into it and delivered that crazy performance.
How much do you like your novels been made into either movies or TV shows? Because you mentioned Doug Ray Scott there. And of course, Crime is based on your novel, latest novel, Resolution, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's three novels, and we've had two seasons. We've had Crime and The Long Knives, which was Crime 2. And hopefully we'll start shooting Resolution at some point as Crime 3.
Okay, plays. You have nominated something entirely different to everything we've discussed. Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House from the 19th century. Why have you picked that?
Well, you know what? The thing about it is that... It's the story of this woman who's having this breakdown and who's alienated from everybody around her. And it's very, it's one of these plays that never goes out of fashion. It's always there. And every time you see a production of it, you think this is, you know, and if you get a really good actress playing Nora, you always think this is better than the last one that I've seen. And it is. I mean, it's a fabulous play. And I enjoy seeing productions of this play so much.
OK, let's get an extract, a clip from the presentation by London's Young Vic Theatre.
I think you should get out of your relationship with Dr. Rankin.
What do you mean, my relationship?
I mean everything. Yesterday you talked about your Richard Mara, who would give you money.
I made up Richard Mara, who exists only in my head.
Is Dr. Rank rich?
Yes, he is.
No family, no obligations, no one to provide for.
No one.
And he comes here every day.
I told you that.
How can such a fine man be so cruel?
I don't have the slightest idea what you're talking
Laura,
about.
Don't pretend I haven't guessed who lent you the money.
Have you gone mad? How could you think I'd ever do something like that? He's our best friend.
It wasn't him.
No, it wasn't. I would never have dreamt. He didn't have the money in those days anyway. He inherited it a long time after.
Well, I think that is a relief for you, Nora. I really do.
A relief? I would never have asked Jens. Although I have to say I'm fairly sure that if I did ask him...
You must.
I won't, but I know that if I did speak to
behind
him...
Behind Torvald's back?
I'm playing out this whole horrible mess behind Torvald's back. I don't see how that's different to talking to
Nora,
Dr. Rank.
I just want you to be careful.
A man can manage these things much better than a woman. Is that what you're saying? That's not true. That's complete rubbish. When you pay off a debt, your contract of debt is returned to you.
So, Irvin, the point you're making there was 140 years on or so. It's every bit as relevant today as it was then.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's like, I think even more so. And it's like, as we move into a kind of post-industrial era and everything's crumbling and relationships are crumbling and kind of, you know, the old division of labour kind of thing is crumbling now. And you see that... You see that the issues, these kind of alienated sort of issues of not knowing your place in the world, don't just apply to women anymore. They apply to everybody. And we're all in this sort of thing. We're grasping for these transient identities that we try to create because we don't really know what's going on with the world. And we have this sort of this existential nightmare kind of looming in terms of sort of climate and population and finance, economics and the collapse of work and technology. So everybody feels slightly alienated. And to me, this play has just captured that kind of alienation really wonderfully. And I'm sure that it will be around in another 140 years.
Favourite book or author? You've given us John King and Slaughterhouse Prayer. Tell us about it.
Yeah, The Slaughterhouse Prayer is a book that it kind of got John into a bit of bother with the mainstream. He used to publish with Random House, and it was one of these books that everybody found a bit too hot to handle because it was massively... uncompromising. I mean, it's like it incorporates a lot of John's own personal politics. So he's a vegan warrior, and he has it, and it's so on the money and but unrelenting and unforgiving about the way that human beings treat animals, the way that we treat animals, and this terrible industrial sort of farming and the carnivore culture that we're in, that we disguise the slaughter and mass murder of creatures, and we make it into food, and we change, you know. But we, you know, what we like to do, that people like myself, who are kind of meat eaters or have been meat eaters until recently, we like to kind of not address this. We don't want to sort of address this at any level. But John writes these fabulous characters that are plunged into this place. He writes from the point of view of the activists that are trying to disrupt the system. He writes from the point of view of the farmers. He writes from the point of view of people who are just getting pulled into this whole thing. And the madness that engulfs people when they take on a cause which is so all-embracing for them, becomes so all-consuming for them. It's a masterpiece of a book, and I would urge everybody to try and read it. It's on London Books, which is a very small press, basically. But you'll be able to get it on the website. It is a fantastic piece of work.
Did I just hear you right? Have you gone vegan? Have you?
I haven't. No. I mean, I have tried for years to be a vegetarian. I've always failed. This time was my longest for a long time. I kind of stopped. I had a fabulous steak in Miami at a barbecue on the 8th of January. And it's so
you
good
can remember the actual date.
I'm never going to replicate that. So I just stopped eating red meat and chicken since then, just to see how it works out. You know, I'm still eating fish and I'm still eating dairy products. I'm going to try and phase them out in the second half of the year. But I feel so much better. Not eating meat. I just feel physically better. I feel mentally better, physically stronger. So there is something in it, definitely.
Okay, favourite TV show. First of all, we asked you for one as a child, and there was one that would have only been available in certain parts of Ireland when I was growing up, depending on where you were located, and that was the show Tis Was.
Yeah, Tis Was. I think kind of we all had the hots for Sally James, basically. I think a lot of guys used to love watching it. If you've been at the pub and you can't, you know, you've been out, kind of teenage lads kind of being at the pub drinking, you come out and then you're sitting there sort of next again day with a hangover waiting to go off to go to the football. And Sally James came on in that leather kind of zip top, like, you know, it was always quite a phenomenal sort of sight, basically. And you had all the great characters like Bob Carroll, geez, had Spit the Dog, the punk dog, which is very funny and very amusing at the time. And they had a great, it was a great kind of mixture of sketch comedy and sort of cartoons and sort of, just like a kind of ensemble. But it was very, it was meant for kids, but it was like slightly older kids. It was pitching to the Viz generation, really. It was pitching to all we kind of we domos that were into sort of football and going out and drinking and taking drugs and all that.
Okay, to finish, we ask each guest for what we call a buried treasure. It can be anything. And you've gone for Captain Beefheart. And I'm sure there are some listeners who will remember Captain Beefheart. But for those who don't or never heard of Captain Beefheart, tell us all about it.
Well, yeah, Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band were fabulous, and they were sort of they always flew under the radar. I mean, the album that got most of the most successful album is probably Trout Mask Replica, but Clear Spot, I think, is one of my favorite albums. I think it's their classic album. It's just one of the greatest albums of all time. They were just I mean, Beefheart was just amazing, basically.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of Clear Spot.
I have to run so far to find a clear spot. Sun's all hot and a rock. Swamps all rotten and stinking.
So there we are. That is Captain Beefheart and Clear Spot. One last thing I forgot to ask you earlier, Irvin. Trainspotting the musical, where is it at? Because I read that you're writing some of the music for it.
We have. We've written a lot of new songs for it. And we're very excited about it. We've been kind of trying to find the right theatre to launch it. We want to go straight into the West End. So we've been involved in negotiations with theatres, and we're hoping that something becomes available soon, because we're ready to go. We've been ready to go for almost a year. We've cast it, we've written it, we've recorded the songs. We know what we want to do in terms of set and all that, you know. So we're raring to go, basically.
Okay, well, it's been great meeting you, and I'm sure lots of people will love hearing you and Eamonn Martin at the West Cork Literary Festival as well. WestCorkLiteraryFestival.ie is where you can get details of tickets, and that is, of course, on the 14th of July. And I think Resolution, your new novel, will be out just before that, will it?
It will be, yeah. And I'll be encouraging Eamonn to behave herself. Like, that'd be the first time ever.
Like you'd behave yourself, is it?
Yeah. Oh, I'll be in my best behaviour. It's her you have to worry about.
Thank you very much. It's been great having you, Irvin Welsh, back here on The Last Word again. Thank you for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.